Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy Williams. And I want to thank Ms. Galen Reske. She's the Senior Dining Program Director. And Ms. Lori O'Connor, Nutritional Outreach Coordinator from Milwaukee County Department of Health and Human Services. And before we go to Sandy, this Saturday, November 12th, from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Destiny Youth Plaza in Milwaukee, 7220 North 76th Street, Milwaukee. Fathers, grandfathers, future fathers, and father figures, bring your families and join Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson and the Social Development Commission at the Milwaukee Fatherhood Summit. Saturday, November 12th, 2022 at the Destiny Youth Plaza, 7220 North 76th Street in Milwaukee, from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Hey, Sandy, I'm going to be there from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Don't miss this one-stop shop resource fair connecting Milwaukee's families with job opportunities, child support, health care, financial health education and screenings, financial empowerment, legal assistance, and fatherly inspiration. New this year, the Family Outreach Resource Room will have games and activities for youth. So bring your kids to have fun and learn about local mentoring opportunities. Register early and take the surveys to be eligible to win gift cards. So don't wait. Gifts and prizes will also be available during the afternoon film for families. So what are you waiting for? Register today. You must pre-register to be eligible to win Milwaukee Bucks tickets to join as a participant or to support the Fatherhood Summit as a volunteer for Saturday, November 12th. Go to Milwaukee Fatherhood Initiative's website or call 286-0222. That's 414-286-0222. I'm going to be a part of two panel discussions, one dealing with violence prevention and the other dealing with mental health. So I'm really excited that they've saw fit to invite me and thought that I had something of value to add. So I'm really excited. It's a huge event, and I'm honored that I'll be a part of it. 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. All right. Sandy, there was something you wanted to say about the three things that... Well, before we go there, Sandy, we always hear people say government is too big, right? And too intrusive. And the one thing I love about the segment that we do with Milwaukee County Mental Health and Health Department, Sandy, is... the dollars are being spent right? Sandy, I'm not hearing you. Okay, we got him?
Yeah, you got me now.
Yeah.
I'm confident that if CJ called in now, he would not be critical of the government money that's being spent for the program that was being described by your guests earlier. And the fact is that there's plenty of programs that the government does provide and that they could provide that would be of great service to our society. You know, we've got, the program you're going to be a part of tomorrow is a further demonstration of the kind of constructive things that government is a part of and is providing and being responsive to real needs of the people. And what I was going to describe, go ahead.
No, well, you know, Sandy, that program has been going on for 50 years, feeding the elderly. What could be more important, and what dollars that could be spent that's more important than making sure that people, as they age, get a good meal? For heaven's sakes.
it's responsive to one of the basic human needs and fears. Social Security was responsive to a fear that people have of getting older, not working and not being able to have money. Medicare is responsive to the fear of people getting older and not being able to provide for their health care. And it's interesting because I talk to people today and people in different walks of life, you find out that almost everyone in America is afraid of something. Young people who are married are afraid to have children because they're afraid that they can't afford the health care and they can't afford to give up one of the couples working. So that one of the problems with our reproduction rate in this country is triggered by the fact that we don't have child daycare provided by the government at an affordable level, so that people literally can't afford to have children. A second fear that seems to be prevalent out there, young people, middle class people, this median income family that I talk about all the time, they're afraid to get sick. They're afraid to go to the doctor and find out they're sick because they know they won't be able to afford to do anything about it if they find out they're sick. And then almost everybody in America is afraid to get old because they aren't able to save enough money. They're worried that Social Security might dry up. They're worried at whether Social Security is enough money to provide for themselves in their old age. And they're not earning enough money, that median family who can't afford health care and can't afford to save for the kids' education and can't afford daycare for their kids. They can't afford to save money for retirement either. So, you know, we've got these basic fears that, quite frankly, the governments in other developed countries are all being responsive to and are providing services that are the same kind of meaningful service, responsive to human needs, that your guests on this last hour were talking about.
You know, Sandy, people before us didn't look at these things as handouts. The people who thought Social Security and Medicare and thought those things through, and this program has been going on for 50 years, they weren't saying, well, this is a handout. They were saying and looking and saying, hey, you know, we've got to do all we can to help our citizens. So how did we get to the point where now government, who created the environment that government is some boogeyman? Except for when it comes to paying for law enforcement or the military.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it goes back, you know, as much as I sometimes respect Mitt Romney, it goes back to that awful speech that he was giving at a fundraiser where he was dividing America up into makers and takers. And, you know, the notion.
I remember that.
The highest in, and I think it cost him election, fortunately, at least enough people in America thought that that was a repugnant way to analyze things. But that is the way many people look at government, and I think it's goes back to Norquist, Grover Norquist, and the movement to basically strip government of its capacity to do things because government was the enemy. That's what Reagan said. You know, Reagan was basically running on the proposition that I'm running against government, much the way Trump did recently, and the fact is that government is responsive. Normally, the notion of government is it's responsive to the needs of the people. That's what Social Security was. Everyone understood that when you got old and couldn't work anymore, you needed to have a pension. You needed to have, and everyone understood with medical care and when Medicare was created in the 50s that you need to have medical care when you get older. And if you aren't working and don't have medical insurance provided by your employer, you need to be taken care of.
You know, Sam, it's kind of like, you know, if we don't correct that view that's out there, that the future and what it foretells for people, as you stated, who are getting older, again, doing that without pensions, you know, and without the protections that your and my generation had, that what the future holds is not very bright for, again, those who are going to be left here and having younger people and having to deal with a population such as yours and mine that is aging and not financially in a position to even do for themselves?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think there was a time when there was this concept of welfare, and that welfare was creating people who would become malingerers because they could get money given them by the government without working, and so why would they work? Well, that same rationale seems to be getting applied to medical care and child daycare. How crazy is that? Do we think that people are going to go out and get sick because they're going to be provided medical care by the government? Do we think that that will incent some kind of unhealthy, expensive behavior? Do we think that providing child daycare is going to incent some kind of behavior other than providing for children and giving them the opportunity to have more fruitful and better lives? It's crazy how we have exported from one concept of the government and one view ideologically of the government associated with what was called welfare, and expanding that to all government programs.
But that welfare that was around back then was dismantled under Bill Clinton. And so the welfare, as people talked about during those times, is no longer there.
Right.
But Sandy, I don't think people know that that's been taken away. And yet, there were some parts of that led people to not want to get out and work because they were, to be honest with you, some of the dollars that people received were pretty good. But that's long since been gone.
Well, you know, but interestingly, there are some incentives built into the current situation. Because we don't have health care for all, there are circumstances that you can actually identify and do the math on where people, like for instance, in Wisconsin, can qualify for Badger Care if both of the parents are not income earners and one of them can qualify as a non-income earner under Badger Care, the family can get it. If we had health care for all, and that incents the person not to work, they actually would probably like to work if there was daycare for that child and if they didn't have to be unemployed in order to qualify for Badger Care. And so we've got these built-in negative incentives that are not negative because the Badger Care is there. It's a negative incentive because we don't have health care for all.
You know, Sandy, you talked about Badger Care. When we come back, people don't know what that is, and they don't know just how important Badger Care is, and it's the answer to a lot of these things, and yet people say no to it. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. It's Friday, and that's Fridays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back.
You just to put it on me, talking to your friends on the phone, airing our dirty laundry. Strawberry, raspberry, candlelight, satellite, television, X-ray vision. What's it gonna take for you to listen? Well, you can change your mind now, but you can't change your decision. You can change your mind now, but you can't change your decision. Cause I don't really wanna talk about it. Many times you hurt me so much. Many times you hurt me so much. There you go again, putting on your own rodeo again. Then you push me out just to flash that smile and last over here. Well, I've been here 1,000 times, I don't wanna go again. I've been here 1,000 times, 1,001.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. Let's go to the phone lines. And Tom, hey, Tom, you say what?
Hey, Earl. Can we agree that, I found this thing online. So the conservative says, if it hasn't happened to me, I don't care. A liberal says this should never happen to anyone, and that's why I do care. And I was looking at that, and I'm like going, you know, it's pretty succinct in terms of what it says. But I'm just trying to, you know, figure out why these people, like I said, my income is closer to the person and the pauper on the street or the homeless person on the street than it is to the billionaire class. And I don't know why people keep fighting for the billionaire class. Like, I don't understand where that comes from, except for, like I said, lifestyles of the rich and famous or something. I just don't get it. I think we can all agree that, you know, Reaganomics and trickle-down economics was exactly what George H.W. Bush said. It's a voodoo economics. And it seems to me that we keep on, even with our Democratic presidents, we kept on with this whole, you know, idea of trickle-down economics in some ways. Maybe not to the extreme, but we didn't go to, you know, an FDR-type platform where who was the one that developed Social Security.
So Tom, I think what Sandy is talking about and talks about constantly is a nation that it's not just beneficial to the people who will receive the help. It's beneficial to our nation overall that the people 100%. Are healthy, right? I mean, that the people are healthy and that the people have a better opportunity at a future. I don't understand the other side of the coin that thinks that if, well, the people don't work for it, they don't get anything. And so I had to pay for my health insurance. Nobody's given me anything. And so it only takes once to go into an emergency room and see it packed from sun up to sundown, 365 days a year, Sandy and Tom, with people who are there for emergency services that cost an arm and a leg. And then all those people do at the emergency places is say, hey, here, go see your doctor.
I think is answered by the proposition that in America, we don't have everyone imbued with the sense of community.
That's true.
In Europe, the culture is clearly premised on community, and here the culture is more nearly premised on individuality. And individuals, I guess, worry about whether they get sick, and people with a sense of community worry about whether everyone else gets sick. But the main thing they can see, if you have a sense of community, is the worthwhileness of the investment that you can make in everyone else's education and the worthwhileness of the investment you can make in everyone else's health and the value to everyone of having the elderly well taken care of so they can continue to contribute all the great things they have to contribute to society. So it's really this loss of the image of the value of the investment of the welfare of everyone. And by the investment value to everyone and to the country of having all these things taken care of. And I don't know how, we just have to figure out ways. We have to get a charismatic leader who is able to talk about this and is able to refocus people into a sense of community.
You know, because Sandy, I do believe, and you see it when people have a-thons, telethons, or whatever, and something happens, and you see people who are willing to donate. So it's not like there aren't people who understand their brothers in supporting and helping their brothers. I guess it's just a matter of getting people to understand not just individuals, but a government can do that.
Yeah. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, that's when we get into the idea of we the people being the government.
Right.
You know, that it's actually collectively all of our little tax dollars that we pay, you know, which I pay more tax dollars, and of course this is where they divide us, but I pay more tax dollars, and you probably pay more tax dollars than the billionaire does, because they get away with it. And they're, for some reason, looked at as these geniuses because they can get away with not paying taxes. And it's like, and then the rest of us are paying for what, a military industrial complex? So therefore, it's like, what are our tax dollars going to? That's why I propose the idea of having on every paycheck where exactly our tax dollars are going, so people can wake up and start seeing it. Anyway, I'd recommend the movie Where to Invade Next. It's Michael Moore's, because it really does point out exactly how actually the Europeans took our ideas of FDR and the American experiment and actually applied them to their own countries, and they've been very, very successful because of it.
All right, Tom, thank you very much for the call, as always. Got to go to a break.
Thank you, guys. Have a good weekend.
844-967-2789 is the number. We'll be right back.
You hurt me so much. Too many times you said it was over. Yeah. 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 Oh, it's hard.
Show as always. You can join us at 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy Williams. But Sandy, I didn't want to get out of here and let you get out of here without hearing your thoughts on Ukraine. And so why is Russia leaving? What's the name? How do you pronounce the?
Kherson.
Yeah. Why are they? They said that this is ours.
Yeah.
And now they're pulling out, and I'm sure it's ruined, right? I mean, I'm sure it's in rubble. Why are they pulling out?
Well, I mean, first of all, it is sort of a strategic place if you're looking at territory and trying to figure out strategy with respect to sovereignty and warfare. And it's right on this Dnipro River, and it's right on a boundary, and it's essentially a river port that relates to the Black Sea. So it has some territorial importance. It also is the capital of the local region. So it has some kind of political importance. You know, why are they pulling out? Well, I guess maybe they've been
completely
pushed
out.
They've been pushed out. Well, they've been pushed out militarily. But, you know, I think we have to wait and see just what they're doing in terms of strategically. I'm always suspect when a country so openly admits that they're leaving someplace. And that they're retreating, and they publicly announce it. So I don't know strategically what's involved with their action. We'll wait. We'll have to wait and see a month or two, and look in retrospect to see what's happening. But I was encouraged by the fact that it looks like America is now encouraging Ukraine to negotiate, and it looks like maybe Zelensky has needed a little pushing in that regard, and it looks like maybe the strength of the situation in this current victory, apparent victory at Kherson, might cause them to think this is a good point in time to negotiate. So maybe we'll move in the direction of having discussions. There don't seem to be any.
Well, you know, early on, Sandy, one of the things that Zelensky said was he wanted to have, before he'd even start discussions, was they'd have to get rid of Putin. And Bush is Bush. Biden has kind of gotten him to drop that, and he reluctantly is doing that.
Yeah, I mean, the last list of conditions that he provided did not include that condition, which was obviously that's a precondition that means you won't have negotiations, right? So. Now it looks like he's opened the door to having negotiations by doing that. And, you know, clearly this at some point, this thing needs to be negotiated. And I do believe that it will have to be negotiated. In order to be negotiated, we'll probably end up with a loss of sovereignty over some territories by Ukraine. And And from America's standpoint, it's probably important that the negotiation happen before Crimea, for instance, would potentially start losing territory to Ukraine, because it's very clear that Sevastopol and Crimea is very important to Russia strategically. It's also quite Russian in its ethnicity, so that it would be a difficult territory for Ukraine to deal with.
So Sandy, these types of negotiations don't happen in a vacuum. I mean, this is elongated, and I'm sure every last letter is going to be negotiated. It's not something that you're able to make happen overnight. I mean, it takes a while to make this happen.
Well, yeah, and I think that Russia, undoubtedly, both sides are looking at the advance of winter as an issue. It was probably important that Russia, if it was going to be vacating Kherson, do it before winter because of the logistical difficulties that winter would pose. Winter will also pose logistical difficulties for Ukraine in terms of offensives. And winter, it does not necessarily impede artillery or the kind of warfare that Russia's more typically expected to use. So I just think I'm a bit hopeful that we'll have negotiations. I'm a bit hopeful that they could be fruitful. It's not clear to me exactly what Kherson means in the long term in terms of the war.
You know, part of this... the Republicans, clearly Ukraine was happy that the Republicans didn't win out, because all the conversation was they were looking to kind of cut back on the support for Ukraine. And the Democrats and Joe Biden want to continue to see this through. It certainly...
Well, except that...
Go ahead.
The Biden administration is recognizing the risks, because apparently that there was a great deal of pressure being brought by Ukraine, but also by a contingency of politicians and in Congress to provide to Ukraine the next tier up of strategic missile weaponry. And that weaponry had a longer range. And so Biden basically and the Pentagon nixed it and nixed the purchase of the weapons and the transfer of them to Ukraine because of the fact that they provided a greater potential for Ukraine to stretch the war into Russia, but I think also into Crimea, because I think everyone recognizes that if the war stretches into Crimea, it becomes a much bigger conflict with a much bigger problem and posing much greater strategic risk as far as Russia's concerned. So my sense is that the White House at least has its finger on the fact that the prolonging of this war provides risks, both of the great expense and the loss of support of Ukraine in the long term.
So, and all it can be, because nobody has a crystal ball, but just for all the world, it looks like, this is the beginning of real dialogue and real conversation, and that hopefully by the time the spring rolls around, this will have come to an end. I do know that there was talk about jets, and Ukraine was asking for jets that would give them some air power, which could only lead to an escalation. And you're right that, even though Biden was willing to go, pretty much a commitment to certain things, he was overruled, I guess, by those real people who understand war, that, at some point in time, we got to put a muzzle on what we're doing.
Well, yeah, it seems like we seem to have an unlimited capacity to give them aid generally, and that aid probably gets expended in large part on American products and satisfies American interests. So, the profiteering that goes on in a time of war is frequently, you know, below the surface. And so, you know, we're providing potentially $80+ billion of aid to Ukraine. That's a lot of money that's getting spread around both in Ukraine and in the United States in a short period of time. So that creates a stimulus that's sort of on K Street to continue the process. But I do think that there is a recognition that the prolonging of this can cause an erosion of support for the Ukraine in the United States, an erosion of unity of the European Union and NATO with respect to the difficulties they're suffering. I mean, you know, Biden on Wednesday was pointing out that the United States was in far better condition than much of the rest of the world, including Western Europe. Well, the main reason Western Europe is in worse condition than we are is the war in Ukraine.
You know, Sandy, I was reading where, and this people are thinking just weapons, but no, we are providing paychecks for the country and for people who are, you know, servants, public servants, and others to keep the government of Ukraine running. This is not just military support, Sandy. It's support to keep Ukraine afloat during all of this. Their economy has been destroyed.
Well, I think the military support number is around $20 billion. And the total aid number that I've read most recently that Congress has potentially authorized, or that the Congress and Biden in their actions have authorized, is close to 80. So that's like 25 cents on the dollar as munitions and 75 cents as other stuff.
You know, and it just gets to a point where if the American people really knew that, I don't know how much they would be willing to keep. And plus, Sandy, I don't even know if the American people anymore are in support of this. You know, early on, the answer was yes. The United States was all in, and very few Americans at all would say no. But I don't think they've taken surveys in a long time to find out whether or not the American people think that this is still something that we should be as engaged in.
Yeah, I think that the longer something like this goes on, and the more you experience the downside of it, and the more you realize the expense of it, the harder it is to sustain support for it. And I think that maybe there's some sobering up as well, and Americans are realizing that we might not have at least the tactical and the strategic interest in this part of the world that would warrant us focusing so much of our resources.
So, having said that, Sandy, now we'll be in this, and this country will be focusing on all of the money and our munitions that we've got to replace. And with an 800 and some odd billion dollar budget for the military, you know, in a time like this where, you know, nobody said for sure, but we do know, Sandy, that there's going to be a recession. I know you have been clear to not say that there's going to, that was imminent. Have you changed your mind at all about it? Whether or not there's going to be recession?
Yeah, well, you know, I think we're going to teeter on the edge of recession here. And whether we actually sink into a real one is a little bit iffy. The things that are creating our current situation might be moderating. The labor shortage is being moderated by the fact that we have shrinking growth rate. The growth in the rate and the cost of housing is moderated by the fact that we have this higher interest. We're walking a tightrope. The Federal Reserve has talked about a soft landing, and that's the question. Are we going to have a soft landing or a recession? So far, our landing is soft. And, you know, so, you know, will we walk this line all the way to the point of having a full and complete soft landing before we have the next growth period? I don't know. We've never really accomplished that in the past. And so I'm hesitant to predict that we will. I think we probably will have a recession.
Well, you know, Sandy, when you look at the fact that inflation is still at 7.7%, certainly down from 9.1 or whatever it was. Things are slowing down. The interest rates for loans, home loans, are 7 point something, projected to go up to 9 before maybe Christmas. You can also look at the credit card interest rates up to 19%. I mean, all of those things, Sandy, have not really curtailed the inflation. Is this something that's going to take a year or two to teeter out?
Well, the question of moderating inflation is a question of how quickly can you affect the inflation psychology. And the fact is that we have lived for now several decades, much longer than any time in the last 100 years, in a period of non-inflation, right? So we had a long period where people got used to non-inflation. Right. They aren't used to thinking like there's inflation. I do think the housing market has relatively quickly come to the view that people ought to wait to buy their house, that the price of housing is going to go down, not up, and so let's wait. And maybe that same kind of intellectual viewpoint is taking a grip on people in terms of buying cars, buying appliances, and doing all the other things that might be deferred. So, you know, maybe we'll get a grip on inflation in a relatively quick period of time. We can all cross our fingers that that's the case, because that's the only way we're going to get out of this without a serious recession.
All right, got to go to the break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. Us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. You know, Sandy, it's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams, my co-host. You know, Sandy, it's kind of like we're in Never Never Land, because there are some layoffs in certain areas, and maybe tech areas in other places, but you haven't seen major layoffs in the
factories.
Yeah, manufacturing.
Yeah, manufacturing. I think that this labor shortage, this inability to find labor when they needed it after the COVID crisis, we passed through it, and now we were getting into an expansion period, and manufacturers couldn't find the workers to do the work, and they left a lot of money on the table because they couldn't produce things. You know, cars couldn't get produced, all kinds of things. And some of that was shortages of people, and some of it was shortages of things. And some of the shortages of things were related to shortages of people in terms of work. So I think there's going to be a reluctance to lay people off in those areas. And in the sort of the newest version of .com, the tech area, the layoffs there are the result, I think, of the fact that it's not so clear the linear relationship between an employee and revenue. And, you know, the fact that Twitter could lay off 50%, now that was crazy, and they found out it was crazy about 2 hours after they did it. But now we have Facebook Meta laying off huge numbers.
I don't know, I forgot what the number was, but it was a tremendous number. But, Sandy, I guess what I want to ask you is, again, and I'm always going back to the times, you know, when I worked in industry, And when these times came, the orders would be down. And are we seeing any signs of the orders being down in manufacturing yet? And if not, why?
Well, I think one of the I think one of the reasons is that order swing that's so radical back when you worked at A. O. Smith and cars was because there would be inventories of cars at the dealership.
Right.
And when the orders when people stopped buying cars, the dealers all worried about how quickly they could get rid of their inventories, and they stopped ordering any new cars at all to come in. Well, most recently, almost every inventory has been very small, and they've been small because of the shortages of stuff. You go to a car dealership, you went to a car dealership for the last 6 months, they didn't have cars. No. They only had cars that were coming in and already ordered before they would, before they came on the scene. So there's been a change in the whole way things are distributed as a result of these shortages that has decreased the extent to which we're going to be subject to the inventory cycle that, that magnifies recessions. So, and so I think that's going to have an effect to moderate any recession that we might have.
So I remember when we went to just-in-time inventory, right? And you know, I remember, and when you worked 30-some-odd years at one place, you kind of see the changes in the way things went. But I saw the difference in the way manufacturing was when I was a young guy at A. O. Smith, and we would run, I don't know, 40,000 parts in one setting. And then store those 40,000 parts. So, you know, one operation, while we had set the equipment up, 40,000 parts, sending those 40,000 parts right away to the car manufacturer. You were storing those things. And then I remember when we went to the just-in-time inventory. We're kind of at that's never changed. We've remained with the just-in-time inventory. Is that right?
Yeah, and it's spread by a function not necessarily of it's not purposefully spread, for instance, to car dealerships. It's spread there by happenstance because of shortages. But there are now a substantial number of businesses that have curtailed inventories greatly. Retail companies have, in responding to the threat of the internet, competition from the internet, have also curtailed their buildup of inventories. And as a result of that, inventories used to be a problem, used to be the situation that magnified recessions, because you were ordering things that are on a regular basis, building up an inventory, and then all of a sudden when there was a slowdown in purchasing, you stopped ordering anything for your inventory, and you started depleting your inventory. And so the business that was supplying you went from a regular course of business to zero orders, and they had to lay people off to deal with it. And that's moderated now somewhat, so that I think that will cause a moderating effect on the recessionary pressure, plus the fact there's this reluctance to do layoffs now because of the lessons learned over the last 5 years in the labor market. So I'm hopeful that a recession won't be so very deep, to the extent that it is moderate in terms of the financial pressures that create it.
All right, Sandy, we got to leave it there until Monday. Have a great weekend, and we'll certainly talk on Monday. Thank everybody who made the show go. Thank you, Connor. Long week, but glad it's over. See some of you on tomorrow. You've been tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. See you later. Have a great weekend.
To be yeah. How does it feel to be? to be you.